I would not never call it that we train a lot on threshold, but I think to train a lot of your hard sessions with control, that I think is very important. And we do that a lot.
The Triathlon Show, 245. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Eirik Myhr-Nossum, who is the head coach of the Norwegian cross-country skiing national team. In this interview, we discuss his training and coaching philosophy for cross-country skiing and generally for endurance training and how it applies to elite and to amateur endurance athletes. In the first part of the interview, we do talk a fair bit about cross-country skiing specifically. Of course, myself being from Finland, it's definitely part of my cultural heritage as well. And it was fascinating to get some insights into the training aspects of world-class skiers, but also insights into things like long-term athlete development in cross-country skiing in Norway. But don't be discouraged if you could not care less about cross-country skiing, because much of the first part of the interview is very relevant for all endurance athletes, no matter what your sport. But if you do want to skip past the cross-country skiing culture and long-term athlete development in Norwegian skiers, then by all means do so. But after we cover those topics, we shift to very general endurance sports topics like periodization, interval training, performance testing, and so on. So there's a lot of gold here, no matter what your personal preference in terms of endurance sports. But before we get into the interview with Eirik, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. You can find them on precisionhydration.com. And as you know by now, they help you match your individual sweat sodium content to electrolyte supplements that are matched for the same concentration as what you will be losing in your sweat. This means that you can easily stay on top of sodium losses and replenish it adequately so that you don't suffer from unnecessary performance decrements or potentially things like cramps, especially in hotter conditions and longer races and events. So check them out and get 15% off your order of electrolytes with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, dry suits, swim skins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear. And they work with world-class athletes like Javier Gomez, Flora Duffy, Lucy Charles Barclay, Mario Mola, and many, many others in both long course and short course triathlon, as well as in countless other sports, including cycling, running, volleyball, and many others. So visit roka.com and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can find on roka.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Eirik Myhr-Nossum. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Eirik. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much. I'm doing quite good. I'm staying at home with my newborn son and everything is just perfect.
Well, if your newborn son wants to join us, then maybe we'll get a soundbite of that later. We'll see. But why don't you start by just introducing yourself to the audience? Who are you?
Well, I'm 35 years old. I'm a head coach for the national team in cross-country skiing in Norway. For the men's, I've been that since 2018, and the 2 years before that, I was an assistant coach. I was a former cross-country skier myself, but that's some years ago. But I, almost my entire grown-up life, I've been a coach in cross-country skiing. I started off with Petter Northug, which is one of the best cross-country skiers of all times. And I was a coach for him. I was a ski tester for him. So I was sort of a service guy for him for 7 years. until I started as a head coach or as a coach in the national team. And in between all this working with cross-country skiing, I also have my academic background is a master's degree in exercise physiology from the Norwegian School of Sports Sciences. So I did my master's there in 2014.
And you also have a podcast in Norwegian, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Me and my wife, we have the same academic background. I myself has always worked with cross-country skiers. She has worked with tennis players, boxers, and more regular people. That's not on the elite level. And we started this podcast, Prestasjonsprat, together last year, where we discuss topics regarding human performance in any type of sport, actually. So, but mostly endurance related until now.
Yeah, well, I mean, that triathlon show has a strong listenership in Norway and Sweden, so hopefully some of these listeners will find your podcast this way and give it a listen. But let's start with the discussion for today. And the first thing I want to ask you is that as triathletes, most of the listeners are triathletes, but there are a lot of cyclists and runners and et cetera. But we often hear in endurance sports in general that studies done in cross-country skiers are being referenced. But few of us actually know how a typical cross-country skier trains. So I think that many times we actually lack a bit of context. Many don't even have never watched a cross-country skiing event, so they might not even know what it's about and what type of sport that is. So can you give a bit of an overview of that?
Yeah, and it's such a huge question sort of to answer, because there's a lot of variety regarding training models between countries, everything, but due to cultural differences and traditions. So I can only try to answer this question with Norwegian eyes, and taking the bird's eye perspective, I would say in cross-country skiing, we have a large focus on low-intensity training with a high volume and sort of level one intensity training. And for my team, which is the national team, 90% of our training is very easy, low intensity. And the rest, the 10% rest, is high intensity and strength and speed work, and this is due to the demand the sport has. It's aerobic capacity all the way, or not all the way, but a lot is decided by aerobic capacity. And we have a competition ranging from 3 minutes until 2 hours. And the sprinters who are going 3 minutes, that's also a aerobic capacity event. So, if I were to say there's a small difference between the sprinters who compete 3 minutes to 5 minutes, and the ones doing the longest competitions from 1 hour to 2 hours, they train quite the same. As I said in the start, 90% is easy.
Yeah, and I think with the sprinters as well, for those listeners that are not familiar with it, it's important to point out that you, as a sprinter in cross-country skiing, you do multiple heats in a single day. So I think that also probably plays a part in making the aerobic capacity so important for that event, because you can't get away with just doing it once. You have to repeat it several times that same day. And
yeah, most definitely.
So it's a great overview. I mean, it falls nicely into sort of the polarized training model, which is one of the main reasons I think that endurance athletes in other sports have started to learn about cross-country skiing, because many studies referenced in the polarized training literature are done in cross-country skiers. So I guess that it sounds from it already that you fully agree with this concept, and that's what you're practicing.
Polarized training is sort of what I preach every day. And polarized training, refers to the distribution of training intensities in a training plan for the athlete. And a high percentage of the training is done in low intensity, let's say around 80, like I said, 90%. And the rest of the training is focused on maybe on the high intensity training. And for us, a rather little of the training is at the moderate intensity training. But this is sort of this is something I preach a lot and that we have focus on. But if you take a deep dive into the training, I think some more than we might actually say is at this moderate intensity, because when we go in a roller skiing track, which is like a ski track, it's up and down, up and down, up and down. If you follow then the heart rate, if you're going with a heart rate monitor, a lot of that exercise is at moderate intensity, but the actual intensity in the uphills are quite high. But if you compare it to heart rate, I think a lot of our training might be at moderate intensity, even though I preach to have polarized training.
Mm. And if we talk a bit about the high intensity that you have when you do interval workouts, for example, are you a fan of slightly longer intervals? So Steven Seiler, for example, has talked about the 4x8 minutes and so on. Or do you include a lot of shorter intervals, something that is typically, you might call it VO2 max intervals, 1, 2, or 3 minutes or so? What's your preference there? Or do you mix between all of those?
Yeah, during a year we mix most definitely, but I'm more a fan of the longer intervals. I'm a head coach for the distance team, so for us the competitions are almost every time from 30 minutes and above. So for us, intervals with a ranging from 45 minutes to 1.5 hours, split up into 5 or 7 intervals. So, but as we're getting closer to to November and the snow is coming, we cut down the how long the intervals are. So more VO2 max, as you call it. But my preference is more of the long intervals.
Mm. And coming back to one point, when you mentioned about the volume that you do, you like to have a high volume. How many yearly training hours is it typical to get for a skier, like a senior skier, not a junior coming through the ranks, but somebody who is already has matured and is ready to handle a lot of training? What would be a typical yearly training hours number?
I think if you collect training data from a lot of senior Norwegian cross-country skiers, they range from 800 to 1,000 training hours a year, depending mostly on the how many competitions you do. Because in the national team, we do a lot of competitions. I think last winter was a bit strange because it was interrupted by this COVID-19, but the plan was 35 to 40 competitions from the middle of November until the end of March. So you do one or two competitions every week, and then you can't train that much. But a senior at the level just outside of the national team, they might train a bit more actually, because they aren't able to compete that much, so they can train a bit more during the season, and that I would say that might be one of the benefits of being just outside of the national team, at least in the end of the season, because the national team always get a bit tired in the end of the season, because you haven't been able to train that much. You have been competing all the time, and then the balloon is broken.
Yeah. And for reference, 800 to 1,000 hours per year, that translates to, I think, roughly 17 to 20 hours per week,
yeah,
or so on average. Would you say, is there a period like maybe summer or autumn when you're preparing for the racing season, but the snow isn't there yet? When are you having your highest training volume, and what would be a typical weekly volume in that period of highest training volume?
Yeah, then I have to say my opinion here is that my athletes try not to have so big difference in training volume from May or from June until October. In plain volume, it's almost the same every month, but we change the intensity. Which and of course you have other things in the autumn which are the restitution isn't that good in the autumn, so it's if you look at the training volume as a result of both hours and intensity, September and October are the hardest. Then we train probably around 100 hours a month, and the intensity is harder. The rain is, the weather is bad. It's dark outside. Sometimes it's snowing, sometimes it's not snowing. So it's hard to have a variation in what you train as well. So maybe we have some more hours in June, but then it's more low intensity. So I would say the training volume is highest at the end of the autumn.
Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking of when you mentioned that you can only speak about this from the Norwegian perspective, and there are variations between different countries how things are done. But I mean, I think that the culture you have in Norway with cross-country skiing is probably one reason for the dominance of the Norwegians in the sport. But I'm curious to hear, like, because I'm sure you know a little bit about how the others are training as well. So do you think there are certain things that you do differently in training, or it might not even be in training, but around training, that you are able to share and talk about that you think might contribute to the success that you're having?
Yeah, and to start off, it's 100% correct that cross-country skiing most certainly is one of the top sports in Norway. We are born with the skis on our feet. And I've got this question a lot and asked, why are Norwegian that good and what are you doing? And I think to start off, I would say that if you take the 100 biggest sport talents each year, many of these sport talents who would probably end up being successful in any sport they would have chosen, many of these 100 talents, they choose cross-country skiing in Norway. They end up choosing cross-country skiing. In other countries, of these 100 talents, maybe none of them chooses cross-country skiing, because all of them goes to football or triathlon or running and cycling. You also go to that in Norway, but a lot of these 100 biggest talents end up choosing cross-country skiing because it's such a elite sport in Norway. If you are at the highest level in cross-country skiing, you're a known celebrity in Norway. And this is the culture part. And
And I think regarding to the training, that the Norwegian Ski Federation, they have sort of been in charge of the development of a system of like several stages of development, from when the kids are from 5 years all the way through to senior age. And all of these stages of development are not only scientifically evidence-based, but they're also widely practiced all around Norway. So every school, every club sort of trains out of the same system. And it's hard for me to say that it is a system, because for me that sounds a bit like old-time Russia or something. But there's a system in Norway how to train. And as much as these stages of development are evidence-based, the take-home message is that you have to train a lot, you have to train smart, but never ever forget to have fun. Find something that is fun for kids to do with skis on their feet, so they're familiar with this. And I don't think it's more to it than that, but it's amazing to see that. I live in Oslo, the capital of Norway, and I think if you, on a weekly basis, there are 10,000 kids participating in cross-country training only in Oslo, and no other country in the world has this.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense, but it's really interesting to hear you explain it. It reminds me a little bit of in the book The Sports Gene by David Epstein. He tackles different topics, including the Kenyan dominance in distance running and also the Jamaican dominance in sprint running. And some of those same cultural reasons that you mentioned seem to be very largely behind those other examples of dominance I just mentioned as well. So definitely makes sense that's the case there. Mm. But also the take-home message, I really like that you have to have fun, never stop having fun. And I think even when you're an adult, a senior, that should be the case. Then one thing that I actually heard that is that your young skiers, they actually take charge of their training, or they take part at least in the planning of their training from a pretty young age. So is that something that you can elaborate about, how that works and what is the reason for that?
Yeah, that is true. And for me as a national coach, I want my athletes to be as knowledgeable about performance and exercise as possible. They are far better experts on their own bodies than I am. I can only speak in general. That I'm quite good at, but they are experts on themselves. And I can only like ask questions, try to guide and challenge their ideas from a physiological perspective. And in my opinion, there's no plan that fits all. I have six guys at my team, and that's also... Yeah, most of their training is quite similar, but there's also some differences, because if they are to peak at the highest level to be a world champion or a Olympic champion, everything needs to be perfect. And those six individuals would not be able to do that if they did everything the same. They need to be focused on what they need, if you understand me, and to be able to have these good constructive discussions with the athletes at the elite level, I'm completely dependent on them having reached a certain level of theoretical and practical knowledge, and that school, so to speak, starts very early on. And I've been a coach at the club level as well, and there, as stated earlier about the stages of development, it's quite clear from early on that we coaches try to say to the athletes, try and figure it out this yourself. Try to have to train hard for 3 days in a row. Find out how your body reacts to that. Try to have no hard sessions for 10 days. See how this works for you. And we sort of try to, at least during the junior age, you try to use those 4 years as a learning time so that these athletes can, when they're seniors, try to be even better at making their own plans, or at least have something to bring into the discussion.
So is there a specific age when this starts, or is it really like you gradually include more and more independence as athletes age, or is it that they start when they 10 or 12 or 14, or what's the system regarding that?
Of course, there's some regulations here, but and some differences, but I would say when they're from they're 12 years old and up to 20, that those six or eight years in between there, that it's a very important age for learning and trying out, and especially I would say the years as a junior, that when you are from 17 to 20 in Norway, it's the most important age, because then you're starting to reach a certain amount of training volume as well, and then you can try to or start to practice some other things. We have in Norway at the national level, we don't train a lot of strength. This is not because we don't have the faith in strength, but a lot of my guys at the team have tried to train a lot of strength. That didn't quite work out. They have tried not to train at all. That didn't work out as well. But so they're, after some years, they have found out sort of a way for them, how much strength training do I need in order to be the best in the world or be at the level I want to. And this is what you use this junior age for, to hopefully learn athletes how to learn themselves, if you understand what I'm saying.
Definitely, yeah. And I like how the sound of it, how it's all basically very organic, like you learn through discussing with the coach, and the coach maybe giving you some different, like telling you to try this or try that, and the body will give you the answer, and you learn about how your body responds. Yeah, sounds really good.
And I always use this quota that me as a coach, as I said, I have six guys at my team. That makes us a team of seven with me as a coach. Of us seven, there's six of them who is really, really great athletes. they're far better skiers than me. So they need to be able also to learn from each other, discuss with each other, because they're so much better skiers than me. So it would be stupid for me to learn them how to ski a race. I can only ask them questions, as I say. I can only point out a few things. When they're going a 5K, I can only see them at one point. The rest 4.9 kilometers, they're going with their athlete friends who can use that into the discussion of how this session was. So I'm trying to give them responsibility for their own training and for the group training as well, not only for themselves but for the group.
I think that's a great initiative, and I'm sure that some other sports and federations have this in place. I know that in triathlon, I think the British Triathlon Federation have a similar concept, although I'm not sure if it starts as early as you do, but they have something similar in place, and definitely I think that it's probably going to follow more and more in the future, because it's pretty pretty difficult to get an athlete to the very highest level if they are completely dependent on their coach.
Yeah.
You need to have a level of independence.
Yeah.
So let's get into some other topics, some more general topics that I know actually that you covered on your podcast in recent months. So with this, if you just give a brief overview and take home message on each of these, then I think that's, we can start with that, and then maybe we decide to go deeper on one or a couple of them. But let's start with just the brief overview and take home message. And the first topic that I want to tackle is fitness testing.
Mm. Yeah, and as you said, this is a topic we talked a lot about in our podcast. This is a podcast in which we talk Norwegian, so I'm sorry to all guys speaking English. But regarding fitness testing, my opinion is that a lot of people test just to test. They don't have a standardization model, which is good enough, etc., etc. For me, the take-home message regarding testing is that if you are to test, you are to test yourself, not compare yourself, your test result to other athletes, friends, family, etc. Then you need to find a test which you can do again under the reasonable same conditions, and don't care so much if you're beaten by somebody else at that test, because if you are doing better, if you're improving, that's the most important thing, and that's why you test, so you can sort of find out if the training is working, or do I need to evaluate the training I'm doing, because suddenly I do worse at some tests, etc. And you don't always need to do this testing in a lab. I am quite more fond of doing tests outside. But I know we can discuss this until tomorrow, I'm pretty sure of.
One quick follow-up on that. When you test outside, do you just use speed, heart rate, or do you also use some sort of lactate testing despite testing outside?
Yeah, when we use lactate outside, it's not in our testing way, is just to sort of know that the intensity is somehow correct for what we are looking for. If we are testing outside, for me it's just the time with what's important. But if you do it in a lab, there's more information you can get out of it. So you can look at oxygen, of course, lactate, heart rate, the ventilation. You can look at a lot of, you can get a lot of information out of it, but it's very easy to drown in this information if you don't know what you are looking at.
Absolutely. Yeah. You need to know what to do with the information that you get.
Yeah.
The next topic is periodization. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. For me, the periodization and different kind of models of periodization is in my head. Now I might end up hurting somebody, but for me, the models and everything is somehow more an art than not. I don't feel like everything is evidence based or scientifically based enough. It's for me, it's good planning of training. That's what I put into the word periodization, and you have this very specific periodization models which you can look at the internet and read about, and there's a lot of, especially in running, a lot of models and strength training, but for me it's not scientifically enough how they are sort of stands out. It, for me, it's more art than science.
Yeah. And next topic, interval training.
Yeah. And the last years, if you had asked me about what I think about intervals compared, at least compared to continuous training 3 years ago, I would say that almost every time do intervals, not don't do continuous training, do intervals, because it's more bang for your buck. You can do it with a higher speed, higher watt, etc., than you can do with continuous training. But my opinion has changed a bit. Today we practice both a lot of intervals and a lot of continuous training. We have changed from almost just intervals over to more continuous training, but of course intervals are important part of every athlete's sort of life, and it needs to be race specific. At least a lot of it needs to be race specific. And if I were to give some tip, I would sort of find some intervals you point out as key sessions where you need to be sharp, you need to be have good restitution in front of, so that you are sharp at that interval. And yeah, as a key session during a month or during a period of training.
When you refer to continuous training there, do you include the low intensity continuous training that I'm sure your guys do every single day, or do you refer to sort of more even things like moderate intensity training that you mentioned that you don't do that much? But is that what you refer to with continuous
training? Yeah, I refer to it as high intensity continuous training, sort of 30 minute all out, 1 hour all out, but with no breaks. That's what I'm referring
to. So the takeaway there is that 3 years ago you wouldn't have done any of that, but these days you do some of it.
Yeah. That's correct. 3 years ago I was more into intervals than hard continuous training. But this has changed the last years, both in skiing and in more general training like running. We do intervals in both running and roller skiing, and we do continuous hard training in both of them as well, which we would never do 3 years ago.
And what is the reason for that?
Yeah, I think it's for me, it has to do with the specificity that you don't always need to go for the higher speed, because in intervals you will probably end up going a bit faster than you do in a race. If you are to compete 60 minutes and you split up this race into 6 times 10 minutes, you probably can end up coming a bit further. But if you do it as a continuous hard session, you probably end up around the same. So the technique and everything are more race specific than with intervals. Not the big difference, but a difference.
Yeah, that makes sense. And finally, threshold training. Not finally, we have one other, but threshold training next.
Yeah, and this is probably one of the topics which I find a bit controversial, and a topic which we discuss a lot, both in the team and with other coaches, with my wife. And this sort of refers to an area, and not a specific pace or watt, etc. And
And I find it quite difficult because you and I could probably end up discussing this topic. And we sort of could be talking about different concepts because there's, I don't know, 50 different definitions of what is threshold. Is it blood lactate level of 4? Is it a blood lactate level of 2? Is it what does it refer to? And for me, it's often referred to as a specific point at some specific pace. You have your threshold, and for me, this is not correct. This is for me. This refers to a quite large area, which I say is the threshold area where. Yeah, you might end up having accumulating a bit lactate, but it's still not much. And but as I said, we could end up discussing this topic with coaches, with the physiologists for a week. I'm quite sure. So I find it hard to have take home message other than don't think of the threshold as a specific pace. It's not because it's your physiology is not that specific.
So to follow up on that, how do you define it? What's your definition of that area?
The thing is, I don't have when I talk with my athletes about today, we're doing a threshold interval, for example. I never use lactate because I find it hard to have a definition. I always say that I use more the language. Like, I want to see nobody's laying on the grass after the interval. It should be done with control. If you're doing 1 hour with intervals, say 6.10 minutes, which we often do, if I were to say after the sixth interval, let's do 3 more at the same pace, the athletes should be able to do this. They shall be tired, of course, but I don't want them to be laying on the grass gasping for air. I'm not a fan of using lactate, and maybe this is because we don't have this. We're not competing in flat terrain or in the same hills every time. We have a natural interval course. It's up and down, up and down, up and down. So where should I, in that case, pick a finger and take a blood lactate sample? Is it at the top of the hill, or is it at the bottom of the downhill, or is it after the flat area? I don't know. And I can probably end up discussing this with myself for some time as well. So I don't have a definition other than have control.
Yeah, well, I think that's the definition you gave there with all the examples of how you use the language to prescribe the sessions, that really tells a good story, and also how you should be able to do 6 by 10 minutes at threshold. So that,
yeah,
that already tells us a lot. And then one final follow-up question on this topic is how important do you consider this type of training to be? Like, do you do a fair amount of it, or is it something that you don't do that much compared to the higher intensity training that you do? I mean, you've already sort of answered it, but
yeah,
is it still important to do this training?
Threshold training? Yeah. I would never call it that we train a lot on threshold, but I think to train a lot of your hard sessions with control, that I think is very important. And we do that a lot. We have ended up having more and more control each year. I think this year we're trying to have even more control of our intervals than we did 3 years ago, when we did more all-out sessions than we are planning to do this year. we're planning to train more, but in that case we can't have so much all out training. And yeah, in that sense you could say we're going more again towards the threshold training concept.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of using session RPE as part of my training prescription. So I will say that this training, this workout should feel like a 7 out of 10, or this should feel like an 8 out of 10, or between 8 and 9 out of 10, that sort of thing. So if you were to put a number on a scale from 1 to 10 on how hard most of your hard workouts feel, or a workout when you still feel, perhaps you can give two examples, like one when you're going really hard and one when you're training hard but in control, what would you say would the session RPE should be?
Yeah, I think you're into something there. That I would say most of our intervals is between 7 and 8, maybe, and try not never only in competition to be at a 10, and save those sessions for competitions, not use them in training. And so I think between 7 and 8 is a good way to say it.
All right, great. And let's move on to another question here. And we're coming towards the end of the interview, but I want to hear what you would advise amateur athletes to do. So do you have three pieces of advice, for example, that you would give the typical amateur endurance athlete, no matter the sport, whether it's skiing, triathlon, or something else?
Yeah, I think I was into it in the start of the interview, and one thing I sort of preach a lot, and which is not so physiologically evidence-based, but this find models of training which you enjoy, find types of intervals you think is fun to do, not. And in that way, stay in your own lane, because if you read at the internet or something, you will find thousands of ways how to do intervals or how you should train, etc. But if the only thing I can say that works is if you were to be better at something or be good at something, you need to do it a lot. To be able to do things a lot, you need, I think you need to find some like you need to enjoy it in order to do it a lot. So if you like running 1,000 meters at the track and field track, then you do that, even though the internet tells you you have to run at least 10K every second day in order to be better. If you like running intervals at 1,000 meters, then you do that, because you would probably end up doing this a lot more than training you actually don't like, but you have read about that it's smart to do. That makes sense.
And do you have anything else you want to mention, any other piece of advice?
And I think this is there's two things which I also think maybe amateur athletes do a lot. And one is that I feel like they always start with the details. And so advice is stop focusing on the details, locate the elephant in the room, because there's a little or no return of investment in starting by focusing on the on the details in that type of sport. If you are a cyclist, for example, it doesn't matter if the steering tape is this or that way or whatever, but it makes a big deal if you can train 3 more hours a week. That has something to say. And the same thing in cross-country skiing. Doesn't matter if you're skis are yellow or blue, but it does matter if you can go more effective by investing a bit in your technique, sort of say.
And the last thing I think amateurs maybe neglect is the recovery phase, the importance of recovery, because you have many amateurs who are training quite a lot. And I know in triathlon, especially maybe, you have a lot of guys training a lot and they have work as well. And in some period, I think they neglect recovery, especially when coming into a competition or something. I think to see that hard training sessions, hard physically workout, that costs. So you need to be able to recover in order to perform at the highest level you want to do.
Yeah, those are great pieces of advice. And the final question, I mean, you've almost answered it already, because you can obviously turn the piece of advice into like, don't do the opposite. Yeah. So that's kind of a mistake. But is there any additional mistake that you think are common among amateur athletes that they should avoid that we haven't talked about already?
No, I think the advices and the mistakes are probably a bit mixed here, but I can only say that I think that the most common mistake is what I said earlier, that they start focusing on the details instead of focusing on the elephant in the room, instead of starting with where am I compared to where I want to be in this sport. Then you start to, with steering tape, you start with brushing your skis on top of them, like very, very small gains. You have people in Norway as well who are starting with altitude training before they even are able to train 300 hours a year. And for me, then you're starting in the wrong direction. You're starting with the details. You need to learn how to say ABC before you're writing a book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is, I mentioned Steven Seiler earlier. He has a good presentation called The Hierarchy of Endurance Training Needs. Yeah. And I've made a podcast episode about that actually a while ago, like 2 years ago at least. But I think I'll link to that, because that brings this point up very nicely in starting to focus on the big base of the pyramid and those first two or three layers. And then you can start to, if you have all of those nailed, which very few of us do, then you can really think about the upper layers.
Yeah.
But let's move into the rapid fire questions to wrap this up. And these ones are short and fast questions and answers.
Yeah.
And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource?
I have to choose a book because it's not so long ago since I read it. And that's Open by Andre Agassi. And this is a biography a tennis biography. And I was really taken by it. It was actually a really good book. Best biography I ever read.
Okay, that goes on my list for sure. Yeah. I like biographies. What's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
It's split between my phone and my watch, because in my work, this is quite substantial. And I have this app on my watch called Race Splitter, which I use in competition all the time. And I love it. So I would say my phone and my app called Race Splitter.
And what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can call it a habit, but I would say my ability to communicate with my athletes, to talk with them and to get them to open and see what they're going through communication. So I would say communication.
All right, great. And finally, is there any place where people can follow you and obviously your podcast, but mention it again, the name of it and so on, and social media, websites, whatever you have that you want to mention?
Yeah, I think it's easiest to follow me through my podcast, Prestasjonsprat. There, me and my wife, as I said, she is better than me at Instagram. So I think that's Instagram, which is more up to date than my Instagram, which is you can search me up. My name is Eirik Myrnossum, but Prestasjonsprat would be the place.
Yeah, I'll definitely go and have a listen because I haven't had time because we scheduled this in within a very short time span, but I'm looking forward to listening to some of your episodes.
Good.
All right, but it was great to have you, Eirik. You're the first cross-country skiing coach ever on that triathlon show, so congratulations for that, and good luck for the season when it starts again, or when the new season starts, I should say.
Thank you very much, and so honored to be here.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview with Eirik. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about this. Eirik is the first cross-country skiing coach we've had, and I do think that there's so much to learn from looking a bit outside the box, outside our own very narrow box of triathlon, and in some cases cycling and running. But actually, there's so much we can learn from other sports, including cross-country skiing, including all endurance sports, but even including sports outside of the endurance realm. But this was just a little bit of an endurance sports detour, so going to from one endurance sport to another. And I'm really curious to hear what you thought about that. Personally, I really enjoyed the discussion, so very happy to have had Eirik on. You can find the show notes for the episode, as usual, on scientifictriathlon.com, where we'll link to Eric's podcast if you are somebody who might understand what he's talking about in Norwegian, as well as some related episodes, in particular the interview I did with Steven Seiler about polarized training, as well as the episode I did myself on Seiler's hierarchy of endurance training needs. On Thursday, we have another Q&A episode coming out, so stay tuned, stay subscribed, and you will automatically get it as it is released. And next Monday, we have another interview, which might be with one of the world's best open water swimming coaches, yet to be confirmed, but I believe that could be the case. So stay tuned, stay subscribed, and I'll see you again on Thursday. In the meantime, if you are looking for training plans or coaching services, please go and check out what we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. If you enjoy the podcast, I'm sure you won't be disappointed by the quality of services and products that we have there. And finally, thank you to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy for your next race, and get 15% off your order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can find on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.